Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm here with Ben Hunter. And we're sitting across from Dr. Michael Mosley, who's better known for TV, not radio. Welcome, Dr. Michael Mosley.
Hi there.
We're here to talk to you about your new book, The Clever Guts Diet. I have never really considered my gut as being very clever. There are a few things within this form that is clever. When you went searching into this gut area, what made you think it was a clever thing? Or
so I have down the years done various experiments with myself which have involved the gut. So on one occasion in the Science Museum in London, I swallowed a pill camera, which is a tiny camera which takes about 16 pictures a second, and watched the journey. You can maneuver it around with a magnet, so it got into my stomach, and then I ate some food, and you could watch the food arrive in the stomach and float around in front of my eyes and then get digested. So the potatoes kind of dissolved into a mush, and you could see the stomach in operation, and then the camera moved on to the small intestine and then onto the large intestine. So I got really quite enthusiastic about the gut having seen this. And as I said, a few hundred people gathered, they watched it live broadcast on big screens.
They know it was science and wasn't art?
It was a combination. But that's kind of when I first discovered that the gut has a second brain. When I say the gut has a second brain, I mean the body has a second brain in the gut, which is called the enteric system. And a scientist told me what has now become one of my favorite facts, which is that there are as many neurons down there, brain cells down in your gut, as there are in the head of a cat. And that makes it pretty clever.
Yeah, my cat's pretty clever. When you say brain cells, are they cells that look like, or are they actually the same stuff?
They're exactly the same stuff, and they produce and they run on exactly the same neurotransmitters, things like dopamine, which you may have heard of, the sort of feel-good hormone in your brain. Well, your gut produces 9 times more of that stuff than anything else. The majority of your immune system is down in your gut as well. And down there, the star of the show is this 1 to 2 kilos of a mixture of microbes, which are things like bacteria, viruses, fungi, and things like that. And down there is a rainforest. Really, it is a more complex ecosystem than a rainforest. There are at least 1,000 different species, all fighting, competing, desperate to live and to thrive, and probably about 50 trillion individuals. I haven't counted them, but I'm assured by scientists it's that sort of order of being. So there is this hidden world, and until recently we knew nothing about it.
Is that what our gut is thinking about so much? Is that why we need so many neurons down there?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about it is it's been part of our language for a long time. So we talk about going with my gut, thinking with my gut, you know, gut feelings. But right. It turns out that this is a literal interpretation. There is a nerve, a sort of broadband superhighway known as the vagus nerve, which connects your main brain to your gut brain. It is really thick and really fast, which implies that it is really, really important. And what we now know is that messages both go both ways, but we also know that, rather like the Russians, the microbes in your gut can hack into this system and can fundamentally alter what the brain is thinking.
Because you were talking, I read something the other day, you were talking about how we're so keen about the environment on the outer side, but we don't really know what we're doing to our inner environment. Is it the bad foods that we're eating, the takeaways and things like that are causing trouble within?
It's a mixture of stuff. What we know, because there are frozen poo samples, which were taken 40 or 50 years ago, and indeed they have looked at hunter-gatherers like the Hadza, who live in Tanzania, who are one of the last great hunter-gatherer tribes who still live, if you like, the same way that people probably did 1,000 years ago, and who have the most diverse microbiome, this collection of bugs, of anybody on the planet. So we know that once upon a time, our ancestors had a much richer and more interesting, if you like, mix of bugs. You have these microbes in your gut, which have been called the old friends. And the reason for that is they evolved with us. and they are responsible for a huge range of things. So, for example, the old friends help discipline your immune system. So your immune system basically has to learn what is friend from foe. It's a bit like a naughty child that needs to learn how to behave. And what your gut bacteria do is they teach it how to behave. If the gut bacteria are not there, it's like granny not being there and sort of slapping around a bit. It goes a bit bonkers. And that's what happened in the modern times. Essentially what we've seen is a massive growth in allergic diseases, an immune system which is rampant. And we've seen that in terms of things like asthma, hay fever, irritable bowel, and Crohn's disease. Yes. All these things have in common that the immune system is inappropriately attacking parts of the body, even multiple sclerosis. These are all autoimmune diseases, and they're all linked to either the extinction or the reduction in the old friends. And this is the production, and this is probably a consequence of a mixture of overuse of antibiotics. With antibiotics is kind of like going into Iraq and just blowing everyone up. And that actually means that as well as getting rid of the bad guys, you're getting rid of the good guys. And all this does is it creates a vacuum into which more bad guys come. So antibiotics have been grossly abused. We eat far too much junk food. And junk food has within it these things called emulsifiers, which is a form of detergent, which gives it shelf life. Turns out that is very, very bad for the biome. And we also eat a much reduced range of foods. We have this illusion when we go into the supermarket that we have a huge range of choices, but actually they're just different ways of juggling the same basic components. Mm. So compared to, say, the Hadza, we're probably these hunter-gatherers, we're probably eating a fraction of the range of the foods. And even when it comes to vegetables, we're only eating a particular part of the vegetable. We're not eating the whole thing, right, as our ancestors would have done. So
we're not as interesting anymore. So when, our old friends are leaving us.
Indeed. Well, the old friends are being eradicated.
Telling the same story over
it's
and over.
The same story. It's just like the rainforest. The rainforest are all kind of being wiped out. And the internal rainforest is also being knocked out. And strangely enough, for example, they recently discovered that women's breast milk contains a particular substance, a type of fiber, which is called an oligosaccharide, which babies can't actually digest. So nobody could understand why on earth women were producing this stuff. And it turns out because it feeds one particular type of bacteria that is particularly good for the gut of the baby. And unfortunately, I was talking to an Australian microbiome researcher, and he said this gut is becoming vanishingly rare in Australia. So even if the mother is pumping out this stuff to feed this good guy, if you like, the good guy is no longer there. So one of the challenges is how do you reintroduce? In the same way, how do you reintroduce species that have gone extinct in the wild? How do we reintroduce these species into ourselves?
So what kind of suggestions do you make in the book? I mean, I've got some horrifying thoughts about how we introduce some bad or some good old friends back into us. Are there less confronting ways?
Well, there are dramatic ways and then there are less dramatic ways. One of the more dramatic ways, for example, is to have a fecal transplant. Feces from someone else. And there is indeed a very famous American microbiologist, and I saw a photograph of him recently in Tanzania sitting upside down under a tree with a funnel in his bottom, and they were pouring in some poo from a Hadza tribesman because he decided he was going to go for a truly diverse microbiome. Now, I have never been tempted by that, but there is a better way of, certainly a more pleasurable way of doing that, and that is by extending the range of what you eat. So what I write about in the book is a number of things. The first thing is about why the biome matters, but I think it's really important that readers appreciate just what this thing is doing. Because I think people have to be motivated to change, because people are incredibly reluctant to change. And we typically only cook this small range of foods and we eat the same thing over and over again. So they have to understand why it matters. Then I go into the science behind a huge range of different foods that have been shown to be really good for feeding the biome. And fortunately, they all add up to these really tasty menus. So there's lots of recipes in the book, lots of menus in the book. And beyond that, there is also a bit on intermittent fasting, because that's kind of if you like, how I made my name when I wrote the 5-2 diet.
Yeah.
But it turns out the doing this intermittent fasting is also incredibly good for the gut, and it encourages the proliferation of some incredibly healthy bacteria, including one with a lovely name of Akkermansia, which lives on the sort of the snot and the mucus that lines the cell wall. And this has been associated with leanness, reduced risk of type 2 diabetes, and also reduced risk of bowel cancer. But broadly speaking, what is fabulous is that the type of diet, and it's mainly based on a Mediterranean-style diet, which means lots of delicious oily fish, different coloured veggies, plenty of nuts, pulses, and also, you'll be glad to hear, some red wine, some dark chocolate. All of these things have been shown to be good for the gut.
We can cook this stuff at home. We don't have to go to Tanzania.
You don't have to go to Tanzania. You don't have to buy a funnel. You can basically get it all, at your local supermarket. So I brought in a number of people to help me with this, including my wife is a GP. She sees a lot of patients. So I wrote a book called The 8-Week Blood Sugar Diet, which was all about how you can reverse type 2 diabetes, which is also, I think, the best diet book that has ever been written. I can say this with total lack of false modesty because I haven't seen a better one, and I've read a lot of diet books. But the reality is there's an awful lot of diet books out there. Almost all of them are rubbish because they're not based on any science. They're based on some celebrity writing on the back of a cornflake packet. This one has stood the test of time, and it's the subject of a whole range of studies. Anyway, my wife is a GP. She's doing a project with Oxford University based on it, but she's written a number of the recipes for here, because she tests them on her patients, and they come back and they feed back to her. And so they've been shaped by a professional experience, if you like. And there are a lot of people out there who have gut problems, and they don't know what to do. And this is about that as well.
Something that really caught my attention was mood, and the effect that gut has on someone's mood. It astounds me that kind of thing could affect whether or not you're depressive or you're feeling glum. Is there a direct connection between mood and diet in that way?
There is a direct connection between your gut and your mood. Mm. And this the thing about diet is it can shift the balance of your microbiome pretty fast, in fact, within days. There have been a couple of big studies that have come out since I wrote the book. One of them, both Australian studies, one of them was about a research project where they got people who were profoundly depressed and they put them on the sort of Mediterranean diet I describe in the book. And a third of them, which is actually pretty high, showed a remarkable degree of improvement simply on diet. And as far as I know, that's the first time that has been demonstrated. And there was another study, which is in many ways just as strange. There's a kind of quite a common condition where you get the sort of weakening of the arteries in your brain, which leads to stroke. It's about 1% of the population have it. And what they found was the thing that was doing the weakening was a particular species of bacteria that lives in the gut. And it sends out a chemical message to the artery, which weakens it. And if you block the message, certainly in animals, and preliminary research in humans suggests this, the weakening does not happen, you don't have the stroke. So it's nothing to do with cholesterol, it's nothing to do with blood pressure, or all the other things we imagined it was to do with. It is simply one species of gram-negative bacteria living in your gut, for reasons unknown, damaging your brain.
Sounds like a bad old friend.
That is a bad old friend, but along with the good old friends, I'm afraid there are lots of bad old enemies down there as well. And it's constant war down there. You may not notice it, but each of these species is fighting for dominance. And actually, it's the good bacteria, if you like, that are holding the bad ones down. And we should be nurturing them, just as we should be looking after our old friends. We should be nurturing these old friends, because they can either fight with you or they can fight against you. And this is particularly true when it comes to things like weight as well.
I was thinking about the supermarkets, we get all the best chosen foods. And is that sorting that they do before anything gets onto the other shelves causing us to have better, or better in inverted commas, food, but actually might be be better for us not to have the most perfect banana or the best apple on the shelf. And there's been a TV show in Australia called The War on Waste, and they did a whole bit on how much food we throw out and how much they select out of what look like perfectly good food. Is that kind of thing also affecting us, that sort of pre-selection by our providers as to what we get?
Absolutely. And I mean, I wondered the other day, why on earth did I spend much of my childhood peeling potatoes? Because all the goodness is, on the outside layer. Why do you peel apples? That's where the goodness lies. Everything else is just sugary starch. So why did we do it? I have absolutely no idea, because there is no rational reason for it whatsoever. And, you know, with a potato or a carrot, I just give it a bit of a wash. I don't bother with anything these days. And the search for perfection has been incredibly damaging. These things, as you say, a lot of the good stuff gets thrown out. I mean, if you want to improve your gut, you know, do a bit of gardening, because you're going to get the soil on your hands, you're going to get a bit of the dirt with the stuff, and it's going to put you back in contact with the world we evolved from. So it's one of the sort of oddnesses of the modern world, is we take all this actually very healthy food, we process it massively, we reshape it so it kind of looks like food, and it's there engineered simply to make your taste buds tingle, but almost all the goodness has been ripped out of it, and all the fiber has been taken away, and all the good stuff. I mean, we still do it. You know, with smoothies, you take a perfectly respectable bit of fruit, veg, and then you basically remove the fiber by just sticking in some enormous blender. And I just think that is stupid beyond belief. And yet, this is all part of what marketing is about. It takes us further and further away from reality. And we are beginning to pay in a very, very severe way for the consequences of that.
Well, you've had a large effect on the way that people, your persuasive persona on documentaries in it, which get replayed in Australia quite a lot, and your down to earth and your science based views have done changed a lot about how people are thinking about food in Australia. And this, I think, this is another case. This new book, but I think there's a chance that we have a turning of the way things are happening, because there seems to be more and more people talking about the way that supermarkets are presenting their food and wanting to get beyond the bull and to sort of make sort of, because it is us, they're doing it for us. Our when we go to a collection of apples, we take the best looking one, and so they go, we better just have only good looking ones there. So it's our behavior that causes them to do what they're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, they did try selling lower salt soups, and they would put them side by side in the supermarket, and people saw reduced salt, and they said, that's probably going to taste terrible. And so they didn't buy it. So what they're doing now instead, certainly in the UK, is year on year, they're just reducing the salt content. But it turns out if you take 5 to 10% of the salt out every year, nobody notices. And so the supermarkets, I do feel sympathetic towards them, because as you say, in the end, they are providing what they think consumers want. Historically, that is what consumers have wanted and may well continue to. But I'm feeling more optimistic than I have for many years that things are about to change, or they are in the process of changing. I think it's going to create enormous, enormous challenges for the manufacturers. Because, for example, when you reduce the salt and you start reducing the sugar content, what are you left with? Yeah. What's it going to taste like? Yeah. Will people buy it? And that is the big challenge. But I think people are beginning to appreciate we're living longer, and we don't want to live in ill health for longer. I don't want to live until 120. I do want to live in good health for as long as I possibly can. These days people start to display signs of chronic disease at an age of 50. Now, if they were dropping dead at 55, that's fine. If you're living till 85 or 90, which is kind of the life expectancy we can expect to, because modern medicine is so brilliant at keeping us alive, you do not want to be living in ill health for the last 40 years of your life, because that just makes you miserable. Top of the list of things which either make you happy or miserable, along with, you know, a loving spouse and community, is ill health or good health. And the danger is that too many people live in poor health for a long period of time, mainly because their nutrition has been terrible during the early years. And you can get away with it for a while, like you can get away with smoking 20 or 30 a day for a while, but you're going to spend the last 10 or 20 years of your life coughing your guts out and barely able to move. And not many of us look forward to that.
No. Michael, thank you very much for coming in. We could talk to you forever because we've got a man who knows a lot about a lot of things, and we could just wander around the park. But we do have to keep this at a minimum and let people get on with their day. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to Ben and I.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And you can get all of Dr. Michael Mosley's books on booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.